Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where long-term performance is driven by original, fundamental research on a global scale. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The secret Swiss bank account is the stuff of Hollywood, all special codes, hushed tones, and financial intrigue. In reality, it's also been a quiet place to hide your money from the tax man. Till now. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
American Public Media presents the Scratchpad blog. Host Scott Jagow keeps you updated on business news worth talking about. Available daily at marketplace.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Wednesday. It is the 19th day of August. We got details today of the settlement the U.S. and Switzerland reached over secret American accounts held at Swiss bank UBS. Switzerland will turn over information on nearly 5,000 customers. The IRS commissioner says the agreement pierces the veil of bank secrecy and helps crack down on offshore tax evasion. But UBS may just be the start of things. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports from Washington.
At least Switzerland will still have its mountains and chocolate, but their banks are in for a big change, says IRS Commissioner Doug Shulman.
It's a real breakthrough. It's a real sense that the world of bank secrecy is eroding.
Switzerland will settle a tax dispute with the U.S. by handing over the details of 4,450 UBS bank accounts held by Americans. The IRS suspects those Americans squirreled away as much as $18 billion in hidden assets. And Shulman expects to collect even more names and dollars.
Part of this agreement with the government of Switzerland is if we find similarly situated banks to UBS, that they will cooperate with us in getting names turned over.
The IRS is urging Americans with Swiss bank accounts to voluntarily reveal their assets. Doing so before September 23rd will keep them out of jail. Shulman won't confirm it, but these voluntary disclosures are reportedly turning up secret accounts at other Swiss banks, such as Credit Suisse. CCH analyst Mark Luscombe says that's going to force Swiss banks to look elsewhere for their wealthy customers.
You know, they're still serving the U.S. market, but not for the purposes they have in the past. And for their growth, they're more looking toward the Middle East and Asia.
Luscombe says this could be just the beginning of troubles for Swiss banks. He expects other European tax authorities to start asking for similar disclosures when they see how successful the IRS is in Switzerland. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Last Friday, the FDIC swooped in to manage the year's biggest bank failure. It facilitated the sale of Alabama-based Colonial Bank Group to the regional bank BB&T. It was the 77th bank failure of 2009, but it turns out this deal was a little different. For most of the previous failures, the FDIC brought in healthy banks to assume leftover assets, and it took on a good chunk of the risk from those assets. But this time, the agency also pushed for something called a clawback, where if the bank rescue works, the FDIC gets some of its investment back. Joining us now for some explanation is Karen Petru. She's managing partner at Federal Financial Analytics. Welcome to the program.
Thanks very much, Tess.
Now, this deal with Colonial Bank last Friday sort of changed the game. Can you describe what happened and why it was different?
Colonial, just to put it in perspective, is the fifth biggest bank failure in U.S. history. This was a $25 billion bank with a lot of significant issues, including now criminal investigations and complexities that aren't typical in bank failures, both from the size and the complexity and its big book of bad loans. But this time, the FDIC didn't just look at it, say, ugh, and hand it over. They looked at it, said, yuck. But in case it's not so bad, we want a little of the upside. And that's the first time the FDIC has ever done that.
So what are they actually getting out of this?
The difference between this deal and the previous ones were that all of the earlier acquisitions were heads I win, tails you lose deals from the point of view of the private equity investor or the bank that took over the failed institution. They got all the upside and the FDIC got all the risk.
Hmm.
In this deal, the FDIC now says if the risk isn't as horrendous as it might be, we get a little back, a quote, clawback, a little bit of profit in 10 years from the acquiring institution.
Is that kind of clawback deal unprecedented in an FDIC takeover?
It is. It's the first time they've done that. And I think it reflects a growing understanding of how to do even these larger deals and ensure that bank failures be handled in what the law says is the, quote, least cost way. The FDIC is funded by insured depositories, but it's got a huge line of credit to the taxpayer.
Why wasn't this kind of thing a part of previous rescues? You know, you look back to the deal with Washington Mutual and Chase, which was also blockbuster, but really not much in it for the FDIC at that point, huh?
I think it was because they weren't ready, they were scared, and they just handed it over. They're a bit more ready, even if we're all still a bit scared, but at least they're ready and they're making better deals for the FDIC and thus for the taxpayer.
Are there any added risks when you use this kind of clawback deal?
The risk might be that some investors want it all, and they might be reluctant to take over a failed bank. I do think it's critical for the FDIC and bank regulators to move as quickly as possible. We really don't need any zombie banks. But they've been moving, in my opinion, way too slowly anyway. So I don't know that now getting a better deal is going to have any adverse impact on the pace of transactions because I think they're already too slow.
All right. Karen Petru is managing partner at Federal Financial Analytics. Thanks so much for your help today.
Thank you so much, Tess.
If you're willing to take a bigger risk and tie up your money for a long time, corporate bonds have become a highly attractive investment. In fact, the total money sunk into what are essentially longer-term loans to companies just hit $1 trillion. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon tells us that may be great news for business, but your 401k, your pension, your mutual fund, it could be on the line.
If talk of corporate bonds weighs heavily on your eyelids, this might be an eye-opener. Morgan Stanley warned today the explosive rally in corporate bonds shows worrisome signs of flaming out. The allure has been much higher returns than, say, government treasuries, but the premium returns can require tying up cash for a decade or more. At Envision Capital Management, bond expert Marilyn Cohen cautions interest rates have nowhere to go but up. And when they do, your pension fund, for example, could be hit with a lose-lose choice.
Do I hold or do I fold? And if you decide to fold and sell the bonds, then you take a loss. If you decide to hold, then you as a pension fund are missing the opportunity of not locking in the higher yield that's, you know, 3% higher than what you bought many years ago.
Cohen says other returns have been so puny, it's still been worth putting at least some money in corporate bonds. But it might be safer settling for less return on, say, a 5-year bond should rates go up in a few years.
So if you had to sell it, you may take a little bit of a loss, but not a huge loss.
The government has helped fuel this rally by subsidizing it. That's investment strategist Axel Merck's view, and he worries it's time to stop before another bubble bursts.
Corporations, they have a survival instinct. They're trying to do the best thing. They're trying to maximize their profits, and so they're doing the best out of the situation. We are through the emergency phase, and so now we need to withdraw those emergency measures, even if the cost is that we're going to have another recession.
Merck argues the risk of recession might be preferable to another wave of big investor losses. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Our demand for oil grows, and Wall Street cheers. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Much ink has been spilled and airwaves filled over how we got ourselves into this economic mess. And now the speculation turns to when the recovery will kick in. But commentator David Frum argues a big part of the answer lies in demographics.
It's an old stock market saying, don't fight the Fed. Here's another, don't battle the boomers. Most of us go through an investment life cycle. We spend a lot in our 20s and 30s as we educate ourselves and form families. We start seriously accumulating assets after age 35. We become more reluctant to take risks and more averse to debt in midlife. And we start spending down our assets after age 65. What happens when tens of millions of Americans try to do exactly the same thing at the same time? Follow the boomers. The baby boom commenced in 1946. It crested in 1958, then tapered away in the mid-1960s. If you knew nothing else about American financial markets than this one fact, you'd expect asset prices to begin rising about 1981 or 1982, to accelerate into full-throated boom about 1993 or 1994, and to slow and cease their growth toward the end of the 2000s. And that's what happened. Of course, other factors have an impact. The asset appreciation of the 1980s was driven by disinflation and pro-market policies. The boom of the 1990s was influenced by technological innovation and the opening of new markets in Asia and Eastern Europe. Still, don't battle the boomers. Now the boomers are entering their retirement years. They will be huge net sellers of assets through the 2040s. Other factors may buoy asset markets. This one colossal demographic factor will depress them. After all, if you happen to be a boomer, ask yourself, what is your personal plan for the years ahead? Buying stocks? A bigger house? Or repaying debt and accumulating liquid savings? Multiply your own preferences by the tens of millions and you have predicted the future. As children, teenagers, and young adults, the boomers have shaped America. Now they will do it as retirees. So as we try to foresee what the recovery will look like, here's the guess. The action won't be in assets. You never want to be a buyer when the boomers all want to sell.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. We want to hear your thoughts. Write to us at marketplace.org. The National Association of Home Builders is out today pushing for an extension of the $8,000 federal home buying credit. July was the last month, timing-wise, in which builders could break ground on houses and have buyers still qualify for the credit. But what if the desire to own your own home is to blame for the crisis itself? John Wasik is the author of the book The Cul-de-Sac Syndrome, and he argues there is a dark side to this part of the American dream. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Tess.
The book title refers to cul-de-sac syndrome. And of course, that I think puts a certain picture in our minds, probably some kids on bikes, cars in the driveway at the end of the neighborhood road. But that's not actually the syndrome that you're talking about. Explain what you mean.
Well, I literally didn't mean a cul-de-sac as in a suburban neighborhood, but the concept that we've hit a dead end and we need to back out of it, that what we were doing in terms of housing was unsustainable. That we were doing it the wrong way. In fact, we were overdeveloping, we were over-leveraging, and we were even doing some things were ecologically unsustainable.
You argue that this bubble was brewing for centuries, not just the last several years. How so?
Oh, there have been housing collapses throughout history, starting in the 18th century, really. And It's the idea that we were obsessed with land. People came to North America to get their piece of the pie, to build their castle. Jefferson built on this desire to own a tract of land, to farm it, to make something of yourself. And then in typical American fashion, we transform this overwhelming need to have something of our own into this status symbol.
Why do you think the house became that symbol?
It was largely a vestige of our ego, of our aspirations, of the things we wanted most out of America. And that's why I really fault the overemphasis on actually owning homes in terms of the American dream. It's always a deal where you can buy a bigger house. And many people did. And they did it because they could overleverage. They did it because the tax laws supported it. And they did it because highways were subsidized to places where there had been nothing before.
You mentioned earlier that there have been housing busts before, and I wonder what your predictions are for the lessons that we will take out of this one. Obviously, right now, the housing market is in collapse. It's hard to get a house because of the credit squeeze. But once the economy recovers and things start to turn around, how confident are you that we won't simply go back to our old ways?
Well, in some respects, we will, because a lot of building and development is based on 19th century principles. You can say that any stick-built home with 2x4s is based on the best 19th century technology available. Hmm. And that's too bad, because we have so many other things we can do in terms of technology and homes to not only make them greener but cheaper, say, building modular homes, building them in factories, making them tighter designs, making them cybernetic. having them respond to the environment and respond to the grid.
But aren't those homes going to be more expensive because of all that technology?
Not necessarily. I'm still confident that there's a Henry Ford out there of home building who will say, look, the best way to do this is on an assembly line. The best way to build these things is in a factory. We don't have to stick build anymore. We bring them up on a flatbed truck. Assemble it in an afternoon. Think of all the labor you save. Think of all the waste you save. Think of all the embedded energy that you save in not, doing it the old way. And you bring down the price of homes. It's a win-win situation.
All right, a new vision for our neighborhoods. John Wasik is the author of The Cul-de-Sac Syndrome. Thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure, Tess.
Coming up, stepping up the search for teachers.
You look at the salary, you look at some of the challenges that instructors face in urban settings. So then we said, well, what else can we do?
But first, let's do the numbers. It was the 2/3% solution on Wall Street today. That's how much all three of the major gauges added. Let's start with the Dow Jones Industrial Average. It gained 61 points to wrap at 9,279. The NASDAQ picked up 13 points, finishing at 1969. And the S&P tacked on 6 points, closing at 996. The modest rally was led by energy stocks after the price of oil rose to $72 a barrel. The news powered ExxonMobil shares more than 2% higher. Chevron stock surged almost 2%. On the flip side, airline stocks, AMR, the parent company of American Airlines, landed down 3.5%, United down 2.75%. Bond prices rose, nudging the yield on the 10-year T-note down to 3.45%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business. www.batteninstitute.org. Why is a cram down like a slice of cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. It's on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. President Obama is scheduled to take listener calls about health care during a radio broadcast. At the National Press Club, a panel examines the privatization of intelligence. Former directors of the CIA and Homeland Security lead the discussion. And author H.P. Lovecraft was born on August 20th, 1890. He wrote scary stuff that continues to haunt horror fans. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. Today, President Barack Obama talks health care reform with a group of religious leaders. Tomorrow morning, he'll hit the airwaves on a talk radio show. The health care debate has come a long way since the administration started selling a health care overhaul earlier this year. It went from a discussion about covering the nation's uninsured to a fight over cost to screaming matches parading as town hall meetings. Now some of the president's supporters are advising a return to basics. Tamara Keith has our story.
With the debate over health care legislation getting more complicated by the day, many people are having a hard time remembering why we started talking about health care reform in the first place.
All of that is intellectual overload for the American public.
Uwe Reinhardt is a health economist at Princeton. He says President Obama would get more traction if he focused on how a healthcare overhaul is the right thing to do, because it would help everyday Americans.
And the central moral issue, how fair is that, that hardworking waitresses and cab drivers, when they get sick, go broke, or don't get care, that was lost.
A broad swath of religious groups are pushing that message. President Obama is talking to them today on a conference call. Jim Wallace is executive director of Sojourners, a faith and justice network that's participating.
In his campaign, the president did talk about the moral imperative of health care reform. So one of his principles is full coverage. we have to make sure that every American has access to quality health care. That's really a moral issue.
But can Americans who already have health insurance be convinced that it's in their interest to help foot the bill for those who don't? Reinhart says there's a pocketbook argument, not just a moral one.
You think you are insured. You are not. You could lose your job.
And with it, your health insurance. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
If you have a young daughter, you're probably familiar with the cervical cancer vaccine Gardasil. It's already been given to millions of teenage girls to protect them against a virus known as HPV, and millions more are expected to get the shot. Yesterday, the Journal of the American Medical Association reported that there are side effects from the vaccine, nothing terribly unusual. But the journal did find something unusual in the marketing of the vaccine. Joel Rose reports.
The article says three professional medical associations, or PMAs, talked up the benefits of Gardasil and downplayed the side effects, just like Merck's own marketing campaign to introduce the vaccine. Co-author Sheila Rothman teaches public health at Columbia University.
The mission of PMAs is really education, writing guidelines, not just promoting a product. I mean, that's what happened here, was this blurring that went on.
A Merck spokesperson declined to be interviewed for this story. The company acknowledges putting up the money for educational materials, though Merck says there were no strings attached, and it never told the medical associations what to say. But the article's authors say that's still a conflict of interest.
The cliche is true. The piper calls the tune.
David Rothman also teaches at Columbia. He co-wrote the JAMA article with his wife.
If you're dependent on a company to support your activity, consciously or not, you will do everything you can to keep that company in favor with you.
Earlier this year, David Rothman proposed that professional associations try to wean themselves completely of funding from drug companies. That's a laudable goal in principle, says Ted Epperly, president of the American Association of Family Doctors. But in practice,
zero, I think, is probably an idealistic goal that's just not, quite honestly, achievable.
Epperly says it's more reasonable for professional associations to keep drug company funding to a minimum and always disclose who's paying for what. I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
This just in, next month President Obama will appear in a back-to-school special with American Idol Kelly Clarkson and basketball star LeBron James. The 30-minute documentary will air on Viacom stations like MTV and BET. It's part of an education initiative by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation called Get Schooled. Of course, to get schooled, you need to have a qualified instructor. And you'd figure in this job market, there'd be plenty of teachers vying for every slot. But from Maryland to California, school districts are turning their focus overseas to fill certain teaching jobs. From Birmingham, Alabama, Gigi Dubin reports.
Evangeline Amen's 18-hour journey from the Philippines ended here in a sparsely furnished two-bedroom apartment. She was exhausted, but she's managed to unpack most of her things.
This is our room. Three bags back that I have here. And I got three shoes.
Amen came to teach physics at a public high school in Birmingham. She paid a recruiting agency about $10,000 to get here. That fee covers her teacher credentials, the immigration visa, travel, and the first few months' rent. But she says it's worth it. Teachers in the Philippines make about $6,000 a year. Here, she'll be on the same pay scale as any other teacher, making more than $30,000. The hardest part was leaving behind her husband and two college-aged kids.
This is for our family, to help our family.
Amen got connected with the Birmingham system through the recruiting firm Avenida International. Birmingham school officials visited the Philippines this summer and interviewed 89 candidates. Amen was among the seven teachers that they hired. But in Alabama, the overall unemployment rate is more than 10%, so the decision to hire from abroad drew an enormous amount of criticism. Michael Todd is with the Alabama Education Association, a teachers union. He says Birmingham should have scoured its own backyard, even looked to neighboring states to fill those vacancies.
If you had to take a chance on someone, why wouldn't you take a chance on those folks who are already available in the pool?
That pool isn't as large as some might think, says April Williams. She's president of the Birmingham School Board.
Math, science, and English as a second language, those are all critical need areas around the country. And for Birmingham, it's been a constant problem.
Williams says they've tried everything. Job fairs, partnering with universities, paying substitutes four times the regular rate. They've even offered a $6,000 signing bonus for math and science teachers. Still, none of it was enough to fill every teaching job by the first day of school.
You look at the salary. You look at some of the challenges that instructors face in urban settings. So then we said, well, what else can we do?
What they say they couldn't do was fill those jobs with local applicants. Jeff McDaniels, director of human resources for the school system, says that, yes, there are many teachers out of work, but
we need the credentials and experience to match what our instructional needs are, and we can't waver on that.
And they need teachers who will, say, show up for work every day. McDaniel says that was a big draw with the Filipino teachers.
All of these teachers have had perfect attendance with their current or previous employer. For us, that means a lot.
Here at Parker High School, which sits across from a public housing project, Amin is teaching the first physics class offered at the school in years. The hallways are dismal and cramped. She has 17 students, but in the Philippines, she'd have 60 in a classroom.
For one textbook, there would be two students using it. That's how we do it.
Just like in Birmingham, many of her Filipino students came from poverty, but her pupils in the Philippines were very motivated to study hard. Motivation, she says, will be the challenge with her American students. In Birmingham, I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note, who knew that among the ranks of epic cattiness, from Crystal versus Alexis to Serena versus Blair, it would ultimately come down to this: Raisinettes versus Cranberry Raisinettes.
It says here that Cranberry once dated that seedy Vino DiCaprio.
Goldie, stop reading that trash.
I heard through the grapevine that she hits the chocolate hard.
Rain!
Oh, snap! Nestle's ad campaign for Cranberry Raisinettes features snotty original grape raisinettes, trash-talking the newcomers. Meow. How about some Milk Duds? And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 61 points, 2/3 of 1%. The NASDAQ added 13 points, 2/3 of 1%. And the S&P gained 6 points, again, 2/3 of 1%. Our engineers include Vaham Baladuni, Ravi Carman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewertz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe. Next time on the program, when wealth is wiped out, health can take a hit, too.
Impotence was the first problem. Erratic behavior soon followed, and drinking picked up afterwards.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.